de la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means
necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to this session on Palestine and global liberation. I'm David McNally. I teach history at the University of Houston, but most importantly for this purpose, I'm one of the editors of Spectre Journal, which is the sponsor of this session. While I'm disappointed to tell you that one of our guest speakers is unable to be here, and many of you will have realized that Rafif Ziad is not at this conference because Rafif has COVID back in London, England. At the same time, we have nevertheless put together, I think, a really strong and stimulating roundtable panel for you, about which I'll tell you more in a moment. But keep in mind the following things, that we're going to start off our discussion with some of the points, and we're going to keep coming back to some of the points that Rafif makes in the lead article in the latest Spectre called Palestinian Liberation, We Teach Life. Many of you will know that in Rafif's career as a spoken word artist, We Teach Life is the name of one of her main recordings, and indeed of one of Rafif's CDs, and we conclude the interview with Rafif on how Palestinians teach life. And so that's the context for some of the discussion. But also you'll notice that we describe the session as Palestine and global liberation. And one of the themes that you're going to hear us speak to is the way in which, although Palestine is a struggle for national self-determination, it is that, and we proudly assert our solidarity with it as a struggle for national liberation, we also imagine Palestinian liberation in the wider context of global liberation. And in the interview in the latest issue of Spectre, Rafif says towards the end, in this sense, Palestine is not a geographical location only, but a symbol for every just cause and a stand against every oppression. And it's that notion of global liberation that we want to pursue in parts of this discussion. For those of you who are new to Spectre Journal, it's available on the table over there. Ashley, give a wave for where you are. And if you are moved and inclined because you like to subscribe to beautiful print publications, the Q code on this sheet's giving you a 20% off during the Socialism Conference. Now, Rafif cannot be here, but we have put together, as I say, still a really strong panel for you. So let me introduce my two interlocutors in this conversation. And we're going to be fairly conversational. I'm going to pose them a few questions, and we're going to have a conversation for about 30 minutes or so, then open it up to your questions and comments. As I said before, we want to talk about the global context. And one of the things we want to be clear about is that the strategies of building the Palestine Solidarity Movement as a global liberation movement also depends always on a reading of what's happening on the ground. Settler colonialism is a critical category for us. It's a crucial concept for understanding the oppression of Palestinians. But settler colonialism is not a fixed entity. It evolves, it's dynamic, it's always in formation and reformation in response to, particularly, the struggles from below by the oppressed. It's reorganizing itself all the time. And so one of the questions that I think is important as we think about building our global movement in solidarity with Palestine is, where are we at the moment? And in particular, does the genocide in Gaza represent a new stage in the Israeli settler colonial project that is going to shape the way in which we organize? For instance, I go back years and years and years as a BDS activist and organizer, okay? But it became clear to me in October that ceasefire now had to move forward immediately as the slogan. I was still committed to BDS, but we had to be campaigning around ceasefire now, for instance. And so what does the current configuration of the genocide in Gaza mean for how we understand the Israeli settler colonial project, and what might it suggest for how we organize? So Iman, if you could kick us off.
Shireen, you mentioned you might want to start with this one. Is that the case?
Sorry, thanks. All right, I'm going to be referring to my notes a bit for this, but for this part. So the current genocide that started on October 8th is truly a campaign of extermination in Gaza. Israel has systematically targeted and killed Gazan doctors, professors, journalists, public intellectuals. It's destroyed all 12 universities in Gaza. It's bombed and flattened one area of Gaza after another and forced upwards of 90% of Gazans to flee, many of them numerous times. So we've seen Israeli wars, speaking of whether this is something new, we've seen Israeli wars on Gaza, you know, in December 2008, in 2012, in 2014, and in 2021. And in general, for the most part, each of these was worse than the one before, but all of those ended after a period of days or weeks. And this one has gone on, of course, for 11 months. And utterly destroyed parts of Gaza that in previous wars, at least up till around, I would say, 2014, there were previous parts of Gaza that were considered safe and not going to be completely destroyed as they have been now. So this is an escalation, but also such a horrific assault that it does mark a qualitative difference from what came before. And as official numbers have said, around 40,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, but these numbers have hardly moved over the past months in the mainstream news. So in June, The Lancet suggested that the number of those killed in Gaza was more likely around 186,000 Gazans, if not more. So if that is accurate, then today that would be around 190,000 killed. And that's, I calculated it, that's 8.5% of Gaza's 2.2 million population. So that's more than 8 out of every 100 people in Gaza who have been killed. And then we saw over the past week that Israel has and has been and is continuing to assault and besiege Jenin and Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank, and it's now conducting the largest military assault on the West Bank since the second intifada of the early 2000s. So it's threatening to extend the genocide and ethnic cleansing from Gaza to the West Bank. But as David said, when you talk about settler colonialism, the elimination of the native population has always been one facet or one of its goals. So there has historically been a tension, as Cy Engler talked about in his talk, between exploiting the indigenous population, using them as a cheap labor force, and eliminating them. So Israel has always had as one of its principal goals, grabbing the most land with the fewest Palestinians. And of course, what this all means is that there's an urgency for our organizing efforts, because right now what's at stake is the continued existence of much of Palestine. Gaza, for example, has a rich history of resistance and of organizing, and now much of that is destroyed and much of the society has been destroyed. So with this level of destruction, obviously avenues for organizing within the society are vastly diminished as well, and that means more must be done outside of Palestine. So I think what this means for our organizing is, as I said, an urgency to organize, to educate using political education efforts, to educate about how settler colonialism functions and about imperialism. And there's an urgency to building our movements and waging BDS campaigns and calling for an arms embargo. But there also can't be illusions in quick solutions either, or in the idea that the Democrats will change their mind, for example, and that they'll suddenly support Palestine. And it's through an understanding of imperialism, I think, that an understanding that the Democrats are firmly aligned with Israel due to the fact that they're wedded to imperialism and to the Israel as the U.S. watchdog state in the region. And that can help our movement realize the futility of trying to just convince them or work with them rather than to protest against them and expand our movement and pressure against them.
Janine. I think, you know, I agree that the assessment of the change in settler colonialism is that, you know, the project has always been to ethnically cleanse Palestine from the river to the sea, to exterminate and displace Palestinians. And Israel has had to, because of, you know, various balances of force in the region and geopolitical considerations as well as internal considerations, sort of pause that project until opportunities, or at least like kind of freeze it until opportunities to accelerate it. And I think that, you know, in October there was this enormous opportunity to accelerate this this extermination and ethnic cleansing. And so I think that the sort of rate, the speed, the quantity of the settler colonial project has sort of increased. And I agree that this gives us a sense of urgency around our organizing. I think in the last 11 months we've seen massive mobilization and the beginnings of new forms of organizing and expansion beyond college campuses. So college organizing on college campuses certainly got stronger. There were more radical demands, more radical tactics. And then you see, you know, the beginnings of large-scale organizing in different sectors as well, right? The coalescing of healthcare workers for Palestine, educators for Palestine on the local level. The thing is that mobilizing large protests is very different work than the type of coalitional organizing that takes intensive relationship building over time that maps workplaces and schools in terms of, you know, power dynamics, that builds coalitions with our allies that don't just show up at a rally or at a protest. I want to make it clear that I think the rallies and the protests have been enormously energizing, have been enormously important for changing public opinion about Palestine. But I think that we're also beginning to feel the limits of that strategy, in part because, frankly, and you know, we don't have the numbers that we had on the streets that we had in November. I think we have to be on the left very honest with ourselves about that. I was on the streets for the DNC all week, and I think that the problem with this moment of acceleration in the settler colonial project is it puts us in this position of saying we need to do something that feels fast and now and like intense, right? Because the killing is going on every day. But it feels like but the actual tools that we have, the ones that leverage our power, take a lot of slow work, right? And so I think especially in this moment of having kind of reached the limits of where especially the top of the Democratic Party is willing to go, right? Like we've reached, I think it was worthwhile to push this campaign for the folks who were positioned to do so. But it's very clear that the Democratic Party's commitment to Israel, especially at the top on the presidential level, is going to be the last thing to fall. And so I don't think that our strategy to, you know, target up here to the top of the Democratic Party, right? I think that's reached its limits. And the actual work that we need to do is from the ground up, right? Including through local And that, yes, that includes large direct actions and large mobilizations. So I think on the sort of direct action and large mobilization front, we need to continue to disrupt the status quo, make it very difficult for especially the most visible, most complicit actors in this genocide, weapons manufacturers, etc., to continue to function business as usual. But we also need to be doing the kind of organizing, right, from the ground up that says, how can we build a base of power that can be leveraged? So I know we're going to talk more about trade unions and workplace organizing. But I think that this this slow work, so I think we're in a very difficult position, right, of navigating the urgency of this moment with the kind of like slow, intensive, systematic work that it will take for the groundswell of support for Palestine to not just be in the streets, but also in these institutions. I'll stop there.
Wonderful. Thanks to you both. And it really takes us to one of the main themes of the interview we have, Inspector, with Rafif. Were Rafif here, she would probably blush if I were to say what is true, that Rafif is the foremost organizer of labor for Palestine activism in Britain right now. She is the lead activist and organizer in terms of labor solidarity. And, of course, we're not as far along in the United States as we are in Britain, but nevertheless, this work has begun. And I'd like both of you to reflect on both the strategic importance of labor organizing for Palestine, actually working within the unions, building rank and file campaigns, winning motions at convention, mobilizing into demonstrations, and so on. So both its strategic importance and what some of the gains and limits, some of the challenges are that we face at the moment. So I'm not sure who wants to kick it off, because you paid no attention to what I said last time about what order it would be. So I'll let you take over.
I'm happy to do it, or you could do it. I'll just give a couple quick points. Okay. So, as you were saying, I mean, a basic fact that our movement has to reckon with is that, you know, we've been organizing, mobilizing, protesting, doing mass civil disobedience, interrupting Biden, Pelosi, Harris for 11 months, but we haven't won a significant concession. You know, Biden briefly stopped sending 2,000-pound bombs and 500-pound bombs, and quickly, 3 weeks ago, he approved a new $20 billion weapons package to Israel. So I guess I wanted to refer to a couple other potential lessons. You know, the fact that our movement hasn't yet managed to win a concession doesn't mean that, obviously, it doesn't mean that we should stop, and that's, I wanted to refer back to a lesson from the movement against the war on Iraq. So, you know, it managed to mobilize the biggest protests in global history at that time against the U.S. Led invasion of Iraq. But soon after that, in the U.S., they folded into campaigning for the Democrats, who have obviously, by the way, only continued and expanded wars in the Middle East. But sadly, a mistaken lesson that some leftists took from that moment was that mass mobilizations don't work, which I would say is the wrong lesson. But it also means that we should be using the power of organized labor to support our movements right now. So imagine, for example, using the power of the strike for the Palestine movement. And then to use another recent example. Imagine also if, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement had used the power of the strike, if teachers or healthcare workers had struck to demand the arrest and conviction of killer cops. It would have made it much more likely to secure victories for the movement. So I think I'll let you speak more to the specifics.
Well, I think an important distinction that's coming up in this conversation is between mobilizing and organizing. So, you know, if we're thinking about, if folks have read No Shortcuts, Jane McAlevey's book about, you know, she like summarizes very well, right? Like, you can mobilize large numbers, especially on the basis of identity or a single issue cause, right? So when we bring a lot of people to the street for a protest, that's mobilizing. And mobilizing is important. But those people then go home and we don't know them. We don't have relationships with them necessarily. They're not plugged into organizations where they can then leverage their, you know, their power in their sectors, you know, that they're not going to threaten a strike. They're not going to, right? Like, that means that we haven't really organized them. We've mobilized them, and that's great. And that's been really important, again, for changing public opinion, for putting Palestine on the front page, for getting us, you know, press coverage. One of the things that I think, you know, as someone who grew up in this movement, right, I've been thinking about this movement my whole life, our task, right, the task that I grew up being told, this is your job as a person who is Palestinian in America, right? Your job is to change American hearts and minds, right? Like, you are supposed to expose, and I did, right? Like, seventh grade onward, every single school presentation was about Palestine. Like, literally every single one. Like, people would pull me aside and be like, we haven't had the Palestine talk. Tell me more, right? The mistake, and that was good, and that's important. Right now, 80% of Democrats, right, the majority of Democrats, and in some polls, the majority of even Republicans think we should condition aid to Israel. The problem is, we don't live in a democracy. Mm-hmm. Public opinion is not enough to change public policy. Like, we saw that. We saw that in Vietnam. We saw that in Iraq. We're seeing it now in Palestine. What actually changes public policy is material, is like leveraging material power. And in order to do that, we have to organize. And that's why we're talking about labor. So let me then bring it back to kind of David's question more specifically. And I'll give an anecdote that I think clarifies this, right? I have a friend who is not a unionized worker. She's a white-collar worker. She's an excellent organizer, has done incredible direct actions around the city, or a mobilizer. You know, I said, well, I was disappointed that the UAW endorsed Harris so quickly, you know, without, like, pushing for Harris, you know, to make a concession on Palestine, since they've been so great about Palestine. She said, well, if they're so great, how come they didn't strike? Hmm. Now, as someone who is organized in a union, right, it is incredibly difficult to get people to strike, even for their own material conditions. It takes years, decades sometimes, of work to get workers ready for a strike. You're not gonna strike, right? Like, and so for me, it's like, how do we start thinking as a movement about what would it take to get the UAW to strike for Palestine? And that's the same, and people are like really mad at Sean Fain for speaking at the DNC, right? And saying, he sold us out. Sean Fain is at the top of an organization. He is gonna represent where his base is. What he's gonna do on the DNC stage is a reflection of our organizing level, right? In the UAW and in labor in general. And so the question is, how do we get there? And one question about that, right, is also that how do we not make the mistake that the left has made at certain points where we're focusing on one strategy, but we're not keeping an eye on the ways that our right to unionize, right, on the attacks on the right to unionize from the far right, in these various legislations. I just wrote a piece for In These Times about Michigan organizing. It took 60 years for Michigan to get rid of right to work. And they were the first people to do it, right? So we need to have an eye on how do we create the conditions that make our coalitions at their best for the work that we need to do. Right? Like, what does that also look like in terms of when we think about the ballot box or when we think about so to me, that's where we need to be thinking about electoral politics. Our relationship to electoral politics at this point is not we're going to somehow elect a president that is anti-genocide. We're not. At this point, we're not. Right? The question of the electoral box is about how do we maneuver our local, state-level, national elections so that we are in the best possible position to do the organizing work on the way up that we need to be doing. That's my two cents.
Thank you both. Now, I said at the outset, and this is the third issue I'd like to raise, I said at the outset that the way Rafif poses the question of Palestinian liberation in the interview inspector is as a highly charged catalyst of global liberation. In other words, right now, Palestine is the key, compelling, overwhelming, overpoweringly urgent struggle for the preservation and the emancipation of humankind. And given that, we're thinking in terms of a politics of global liberation, or, I hope at a socialism conference, no one will be offended if I say, of world revolution and international socialism. Since we're thinking in those terms, of course, it has implications for how we think about the kind of movement we're trying to build. I want to take off on Iman's distinction between mobilizing and organizing, which I think is crucial. One of the things that makes movements sustainable in the long term and enables their growth is that hundreds and then thousands of new organizers are being trained in the movement so that they're going out and extending its reach, taking it into places from schools to neighborhoods to union locals to unorganized workplaces where the movement has never existed before. And to do that, the movement has to have enormously participatory spaces. Spaces where people can come and learn, debate strategy and tactics, come together after the debates in United Action, and grow as activists and organizers through that process. Shireen has heard me say, maybe to the point of boredom, that when I was a teenager in Toronto joining the anti-Vietnam War movement, yeah, I know I'm dating myself, but as a teenager, joining the anti-Vietnam War movement. Every month, I could go from the working-class suburban area that I lived downtown to the monthly coordinating campaign meetings where what the movement was going to be doing over the next period was openly discussed. Yeah. And as a 15, 16-year-old, I could sit in these debates. To be honest, I'm much more comfortable speaking now. I didn't get up and speak very much as a 15, 16-year-old, but I was learning. I was being educated by organizers who were well ahead of me in terms of their strategic vision and so on. But those mass participatory collective spaces and democratic spaces were, in my experience, critical to movement building. So I'd like to hear both of you talk about what some of the challenges are and where we need to be imagining, envisioning where we need to be taking this movement.
I mean, I love that question. I mean, we've had such an assault on the common, right? Like, we have so few decommodified spaces and so few spaces that we, in which we can be in community, you know, with each other. This is me pausing to tell myself not to go on a rant about how Obama wants to privatize a beautiful part of Lakeshore. Yeah, I mean, I think that our, you know, yesterday we had a panel on grief and care in our movements, and we talked about the need for, and I see some of my comrades in the room that I've been talking to about this, that the need to have parallel spaces, right? Spaces for the strategy conversations, the tactics conversations, the long-term building, the power mapping, and spaces where we can kind of share, you know, like build community with each other, get to know each other as people. And I think, I mean, I think returning to our sort of labor, you know, one of the points that Jane McAlevey makes in this book, No Shortcuts, is that a left-wing union, right, a union that is active not just as a space to increase wages and get benefits, a union that is seen as part of people's lives, right? Like that it's the kind of, that sees these individuals as whole, right? Is also a union that people are more invested in, right? So I think thinking about our movements, So I think thinking about the spaces that we build, right, these slow, deliberative spaces, as spaces that cultivate, that help cultivate our whole lives and our relationships with each other. one significant moment for me, you know, early in the fall was, you know, I was invited to read from Everything for Everyone at Pilsen Community Books, which I always want to plug because they're so wonderful. And I found myself sitting next to Bill Ayers and Barbara Ransby, and you know, they were talking about the latest developments, and Bernadine Dorn, and they were talking about the latest developments and the thing, and it just hit me in this moment where I was like, oh right, we're in this for a lifetime. Like, we're in this for a life, like sitting next to movement elders, I was like, oh. And so I think we have to also resist the siloing of our movements. And this, in some ways, returns to the very first question about urgency, right? That a lot of folks that are coming in because coming into our movement spaces, coming into left spaces because of Palestine, need to also be brought into the idea that even if we were able to liberate Palestine tomorrow, or liberate it in some version, some limited version of liberation that you can have under capitalism or the nation state, right? We would still have a lot of work to do. And so I think it's very, so I think that's that the orientation needs to be, so again, we have to balance two seemingly contradictory things. On the one hand, this strategy towards winning, right? Towards achieving achievable goals, like one after the other, right? And on the other hand, having an eye on a revolutionary horizon that says that these achievable goals from now, like that we're getting bit by bit, are not the end, right? That like whatever thing that we win is not the last thing, it's the beginning. It's something to build on, to build on, to build on, to build on. And I think that orientation is a resistance of the ways, the kind of like liberal washing of movements and the liberals kind of siloing of movements into like specific issues, right? I think that's an ethos that we need to bring into the spaces that we're building out right now. Yeah.
Yeah, I think in terms of the challenges of the movement, I would definitely say the first one is a lack of space to debate around strategy. And I think this has been true for years in the left. We're really lacking spaces to think about how together and strategize how do we move forward and how do we learn from lessons from the past. And I think, you know, unfortunately, Twitter has become that space at times, but it can't substitute for healthy spaces where we can debate what tactics to move forward. I'm thinking of during like the Bowman debate, there are spaces were actually shut down in parts of the left instead of being encouraged to bring forward debate. And that was super highly undemocratic, and that was a real problem for the, I mean, that alienated a lot of Palestinians, Muslims, and Arabs from the DSA because the BDS and Palestine Working Group wasn't encouraged to put forward their analysis and thinking. And then people were upset that those discussions took place on Twitter. But it was, the Bowman debate was basically a moment where Jamal Bowman, who was New York City representative and elected representative and a member of the DSA, he continually voted to send more money and arms to Israel and basically violate the terms of the DSA. So there was a movement, almost a mini revolt within the DSA, where all these chapters were demanding, you know, he has to stop that or stop being a member of the DSA. And the leadership shut down the leadership of the BDS and Palestine Working Group, which I was a part of at the time, banned our Twitter account. And we were actually trying to have webinars to debate and talk about strategy, and inviting hundreds of people. And that was like the only avenue at the time. So that shows a real problem in terms of what spaces there are for democratic discussion and healthy debate on the left. And I think you were referring to this. I also like the fact that our movement has been so segregated, the movement in solidarity with Palestine. So, for example, in New York City, where I spend some of my time, there are protests by different groups, like sometimes
the same day in different places instead of all coming together under one umbrella or I do think there is a need for a broader coalition that brings people together nationally, perhaps led by SJP students. And another thing, we recently did I interviewed Iman for the next issue of Spectre. We were talking about...
Subscribe.
Yes. we were talking about, you know, issues of leadership within the student movement and the fact that... I mean, one amazing thing is that the encampment movement did allow spaces for, you know, different universities were... the activists on the universities, the SJPs, to be more specific, were experimenting with different tactics and strategies, and some worked really well, and others, you know, hopefully they'll learn from the mistakes of the last semester, and part of that is finding ways to have healthy leadership structures and. Yeah, again, healthy spaces to debate and discuss these.
If I may just add one thing, because you brought up the online thing, and if anyone has had the mispleasure of hearing me rant this weekend, it's like, I'm like, ah! Part of the problem with the kind of social media model of debate, right, is that it is very good at homogenizing, like, one correct line. And the other thing, and I think we've learned this from watching Uncommitted at the DNC, is that social media makes it almost impossible to distinguish between political theater, which frankly we also need to engage in, right? Like political theater and the actual sort of pure ideological line, right? There is a difference between the two, and sometimes political theater is a strategy, right? Like the putting on of a sort of like, and then we wanted this thing and they didn't give it to us. And that is, you know, that can be a strategy. It doesn't actually necessarily represent people's like ideological end all be all. And the thing is, on Twitter and on social media, it becomes very easy to coalesce around, like, here is one slogan, here's one, like, 280-character slogan that is the correct political line. And if you are not in this, right, then you're a liberal shill, and you're this, and you're that, right? And it's very defeating. And the other problem with social media is that it's very hard to distinguish the actors involved, right? You see a slide deck on Instagram, and it's like, you know, all the marshals at this protest are cops, you know, and you're like, okay, but who are you? But who are you? And how do I hold you accountable if you're wrong, right? And are you part of this coalition? Like, who are you, though? And that's the problem. Like that, and the other thing on social media is, like, sometimes, you know, people have opinions and you're like, have you ever organized anything, though? Right? Like, have you ever organized anything? Or are you... Again, social media has been an incredibly important tool for us. I'm not, you know, but so I think we have to recognize the limits of that space, right? That social media needs to be a tool. It's not the end of this situation. It's not. It's a means, and so it can't replace the spaces that you gesture to in your question, David. It can't replace these spaces of debate. It can't be where we come up with all strategy. And the slogans are not strategy. They can be, but they're not. They're not the same thing. I want a what then? Like, if you're going to give me a political imperative or a political don't do this, what then? Right? What's your game plan? Right? For winning something. That's what I want to know. And I think that's what we should be asking people who are issuing us political imperatives. Done with rant. Okay.
All right. Big thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.